Welcome to El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine. International Federation of Clinical Chemistry, IFCC. Executive Director, Dr. Hernan Ferres-Tayeb.
Member of the Committee of Evidence-Based Laboratory Medicine of the International Federation of Clinical Chemistry.
Organizing Committee, Dr. Maria Montserrat Blanes Gonzalez from Paraguay, Dr. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico, and Dr. Estela Raimondo from Uruguay.
El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry. El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
El Microscopio is presenting the IFCC World Lab Congress 2017.
El Microscopio, where health professionals can meet over the internet.
We are thankful to the audience. We have more than 100,300 Facebook likes. Let's go for more.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
The Spanish Association of Pharmaceutical Analysts and the Chilean Society of Clinical Chemistry accompany El Microscopio.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Professor Virgil Elena is Associate Professor in the Division of Gastroenterology in the Department of Medicine. He's a member of the Pharmacon Family Digestive Health Research Institute. She is interested in the pathogenesis of chronic inflammatory disorders such as celiac disease. She is also investigating host-bacterial interactions, in particular in the context of probiotics and functional gastrointestinal diseases, at the University of McMaster, Canada.
Professor Virgil Elena, welcome to Microscopio.
Thank you very much for having me.
In this interview, we wanted to talk about celiac disease. And our first question is, what is the function of intestinal microbiota?
So the term intestinal microbiota refers to a complex community of microorganisms that live in our gut. And this includes bacteria, but also virus and fungi. So mostly when we talk about intestinal microbiota, we refer to bacteria, but we have to remember that there are other components like virus and fungi. So this community has adapted to live in our intestines without producing any harm. And as a matter of fact, they add on to our capacity to, for example, metabolize food or other substances, as well as instructs our immune system.
Could you please tell us about the role of the microbiome as possible moderator of our gut health and innate immune system?
Sure. So this relates to the previous question. So since our gut microbiota has adapted to live in our body without producing harm, then they are different in that sense from bugs that could cause disease. So, for example, such as pathogens that cause gastroenteritis. And the way they have adapted to live in this commensal situation is that they regulate immune responses in a way that they are toned down so as not to react to this community of bacteria and cause inflammation, but at the same time instructing the immune system of how to be prepared in the case of an infection that could cause harm.
And research shows that metagenomics is a genetic richness associated with better health. Could you please tell us about that concept?
So this concept is not that straightforward. It is a little bit controversial. It is true that metagenomic studies, some of them, have indicated that there is a higher diversity in situations of health than in disease. But the topic is a little bit more complicated than just saying high diversity, low diversity, health versus disease. So there are disease situations, for example, when a true pathogen is present. The best example is, for example, Clostridium difficile, when, of course, this pathogen is driving a decrease in diversity. But lower diversity does not always mean disease. So I think that the concept is coming up that it's more important to talk about more than these associations of high or low diversity. What we really need is proof of concept of causative effects of changes in the microbiome with specific diseases.
And what microorganisms make the microbiome?
So what I said before, the microbiome is composed of bacteria, virus, fungi, and that most of our knowledge comes from the bacterial component, but we are starting to investigate the role of virum and the fungum as well. So within bacteria, we can subdivide according to phylum, and most humans have two or three dominant phyla, like Firmicutes, Actinobacteria, Bacteria. But within each phylum, there are many different genus and species.
And what is the role of the enteric nervous system, known as the second brain?
So the enteric nervous system is a complex arrangement of neurons that we have within the gut wall. They are divided in two plexi in the gut wall. And the role of the enteric nervous system is to control functions, just as gut motor activities, secretions, which are essential for normal digestion, for normal bowel function. So these activity of these neurons within the gut are independent from the brain, but they are tightly controlled by the brain through neural pathways as well as by hormones and other molecules that can signal to the brain. So in this way, the second brain or the little brain or the enteric nervous system is not dictated by the brain, but it's kept in check by the brain. And this, for example, permits to inhibit situations like defecation when it is not socially possible. Although the enteric nervous system may promote that activity, the brain is going to say, this situation is not possible because you are at a meeting with your boss.
How is microbiome formed and what factors are involved?
The microbiome, and I'm mainly talking about the gut microbiome, but we must remember that there's a microbiome, for example, on the skin. So the microbiome in general is acquired at birth by passage of the baby through the vaginal canal. And once the baby is born and has acquired that initial inoculum, to call it that way, from the mother, the baby will continue to acquire microorganisms that come from the environment, from the hospital environment, the house environment, and of course another important element that is going to contribute to shape this community of bacteria will be food, the ingestion of food.
And how is it associated with dysbiosis?
It is very difficult to define dysbiosis. It's a term that is much used and associated with diseased states, but not everyone coincides in defining dysbiosis. So in general terms, this implies a deviation from the normal microbiome. But in all honesty, we cannot today define properly a normal microbiome either. One could say that a normal microbiome is one which is adapted to the individual, that does not cause harm, that protects from disease, and that any deviation, any perturbation from that stability could be interpreted as dysbiosis and could promote disease.
And how can we improve or develop microbiome?
So this is also a tricky question because there is no direct answer to it. So it relates to what we already discussed, right? Definition of the microbiome and what is normal and what is abnormal. So any infection, antimicrobial, antibiotics, or even a certain kind of diet could change your microbiome and promote a certain disease. So you could use this same idea to restore it to an equilibrium. So there are many groups that are working on probiotic approaches and food-related approaches, what we call the prebiotic approach, to reshape the microbiome. But we need to keep in mind that if we don't have a clear idea of what a normal microbiome is, then we could be inducing changes that are unwanted with these strategies, and we need more research.
What is the influence of the microbiome on the diseases related to gluten?
Because we haven't talked about this before, so diseases related to gluten are all those that could be triggered by the ingestion of gluten-containing foods, like, for example, cereals like wheat, rye, and barley. The typical disease which is associated with this and triggered by gluten is celiac disease. But there could be other non-celiac conditions that could develop from an abnormal reaction to gluten. So the relationship of microbes in gluten-related disorders, or more specifically in celiac disease, this is just beginning to emerge. So I told you at the beginning of the conversation that the intestinal microbiota could help the host, the person that is harboring that microbiota, in metabolizing food. So we know that bacteria are metabolically very active. They produce many enzymes and many other molecules that could have an impact on the host. And with respect to gluten, and this is something that my group has been working on, we found that some bacteria from celiac patients, bacteria that are what we call opportunistic pathogens, they could sit between, you know, being a commensal but could turn dangerous at certain points. And commensals, such as lactobacillus, are different from the ones we found in healthy people. And they have different gluten-degrading capacity. And so, for example, we have found that an opportunistic pathogen from celiac people can metabolize gluten in such a way that they produce gluten peptides that can induce inflammation in celiacs. While if we add lactobacillus to that metabolic activity, then those gluten peptides are metabolized completely and the inflammatory capacity is reduced. So just to put it in simple words, what the results of these investigations tell us is that perhaps there are interactions between gut bacteria and the ingested gluten in the food you consume that could influence the risk of a person to react in a bad way or in a good way to gluten.
And could you please tell us about the importance of the intestinal barrier in the intestinal homeostasis?
Before saying this, perhaps we should explain what the intestinal barrier is. This is, again, a very broad term, and it refers to a structural barrier that is given by the cells that line the inner surface of our guts, but also many other cells, immune cells that infiltrate, that live in the gut wall and that produce, for example, immunoglobulins that can block bacteria. The substances like antimicrobials that are produced by our own cells that can keep bacteria in check. So all these functions combine to form the intestinal barrier. And you will have, for example, terms like intestinal permeability, which is part of what we consider the intestinal barrier, but the intestinal barrier is much more than just letting substances in or out. So you can imagine that maintaining overall all these functions, structural, immune, and permeability, is essential to keep us healthy, and that any breach in this barrier could allow massive amounts of material that are normally in the gut lumen into the body, and that could cause harm or inflammation.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Virtue Elena. It has been a pleasure to have you in Microscopio.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
El Microscopio, where health professionals can meet over the Internet.
Microscópio.
Well, you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go. The bottom of your glass, hoping one day you'll make a dream last. But dreams come slow and they go so fast. You see it when you close your eyes. Maybe one day you'll understand why. Everything you touch surely dies. But you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. Staring at the ceiling in the dark. Same old empty feeling in your heart. Cause love comes slow and it goes so far. Will you see her when you fall asleep? But never to touch and never to keep. Cause you loved her too much and you dive too deep. Where you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go. Oh, 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 no. And you let her go. Burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world. Our correspondents in every country. Alberto Barrantes in Costa Rica. Álvaro Justiniano Gross in Bolivia. Ana Leticia Maceli in Guatemala. Carmen Cecilia Almonacid Urrego in Colombia. Cristina Cerveto from Uruguay. Eduardo Aranda in Chile. Graciela Velázquez from Paraguay. María del Carmen Pasquel from Ecuador.
We are in El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com
on Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Argentina time
and at 10 a.m.
Chihuahua and Nicaragua time.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Dr. Jason Park is an associate professor in the Department of Pathology at the Eugene McDermott Center for Human Growth and Development at UT Southwestern Medical School. He is the medical director of the Advanced Diagnostics Laboratory at Children's Health, Children's Medical Center, Dallas. Dr. Park's clinical and research interests are in genomic medicine, gastrointestinal diseases, and clinical informatics. He is certified by the American Board of Pathology, Clinical Informatics, Clinical Pathology, and Anatomic Pathology, as well as the American Board of Clinical Chemistry in Molecular Diagnosis.
Professor Jason Park, welcome to El Microscopio. We wanted to ask you, when was the IFSC Working Group on Cancer Genomics established, and what is the mission of this working group?
The IFCC Working Group on Cancer Genomics was established in 2015 with a mission to survey the currently used and emerging technologies in clinical cancer genomics, and we desire to establish a framework to guide clinical laboratories.
How was the genome sequence evolved in terms of time and cost?
The first international effort, known as the Human Genome Project, resulted in the first draft human genome sequence in 2001. At that time, the total project cost was estimated to be $2.7 billion, and it took a decade to complete. In 2003, it was estimated that to perform each additional human genome sequence would cost $50 million in 3 to 4 months. Currently, there have been tremendous changes, and it is now feasible to sequence a single human genome for less than $1,000 in a single day. Now, each unit of DNA is called a base or base pair, and a human genome has 3 billion bases. At its best, the traditional sequencing method known as Sanger sequencing could analyze millions of bases of DNA in a single day. Currently, a tabletop instrument, such as the sequencer from the Illumina Corporation known as the NextSeq 500, it can analyze over 100 billion bases in a single day. The key technological advancement for the improvement in sequencing efficiency was the introduction of so-called massively parallel sequencing, which was commercialized in 2005. Prior to massively parallel sequencing, traditional DNA sequencing, including the Human Genome Project, was performed by Sanger technology, which had been developed in the 1970s. Sanger sequencing focused on single regions of DNA and could analyze hundreds of bases at a time. In contrast, massively parallel sequencing examines tens of millions of regions of DNA at the same moment or in parallel.
Why is cancer sequencing analysis complex?
Although human genome sequencing has become routine in many research centers, there are specific technical and biological challenges for sequencing cancer specimens. First, most cancer specimens have been processed by harsh chemicals such as formalin. This chemical treatment occurs because the first priority for cancer specimens is a microscopic diagnosis and classification. The chemical treatment with agents such as formalin fragment and degrade DNA. This makes it much more difficult to sequence. Second, most cancer specimens are not purely cancer, but a mixture of cancer with non-cancerous tissues such as blood vessels, fat, skin, or normal organs. When a non-pure specimen is sequenced, the results are a mixture of cancer and non-cancer genomes. To address this problem, much more sequencing, on the order of 5 to 10 times as much, must be performed to adequately evaluate the mixed sample. In addition, there are biological issues with cancer genomes. Cancers are not uniform in their genomes. A person's cancer may have many subpopulations, each with a specific genomic characteristic. This is referred to as cancer heterogeneity, and it is a clinical problem with cancer genomic evaluation. A subpopulation of cancer cells may have a key mutation, which may result in the recurrence of a cancer or the development of metastatic disease. However, this subpopulation may be less than 5% of the cells. Similar to the issue with a mixture of cancer with non-cancer cells, addressing cancer heterogeneity requires much more sequencing, on the order of 10 to 100 times more sequencing compared to non-cancerous conditions. Because of the significantly greater amount of sequencing required per cancer specimen, an alternative to sequencing the whole genome of a specimen is to sequence a targeted number of genes. Clinical cancer tests for targeted gene sequencing are available and typically analyze on the order of tens to hundreds of genes rather than the 20,000 plus genes in the human genome.
The key in genetic medicine is to find the genes that are connected to the therapeutic interventions. How many genes are related to the therapeutic interventions and for what types of cancer?
In the United States, the Food and Drug Administration currently only has several dozen agents which are approved to target specific biomarkers and/or mutations. These agents include drugs which target well-known genetic alterations such as HER2NU, also known as ERBB2, EGFR, KIT, and ALK. However, there are currently over 500 clinical oncology trials in the world which are evaluating over 400 novel compounds for targeted therapy. In a 2014 review of cancer oncology trials, there were estimated to be at least 500 genes which are altered in cancer and which are thought to be possible targets for a therapeutic. The key hurdle in cancer genomics is no longer the ability to sequence cancers. This is now becoming routine. But rather, the challenge is testing and finding effective therapeutic agents. Over the past 2 years, there's been a major shift in cancer clinical trials. This migration has been to a so-called basket design, which focuses on cancer genetic variation rather than the microscopic or histologic subtype. This novel basket trial design allows for grouping of many different cancer types into molecular categories rather than the microscopic or histologic subtype. This new type of grouping permits the rapid evaluation of multiple therapeutic agents in parallel. In the United States in 2015, a major basket trial was launched known as the NCI Match. The NCI Match trial, which is ongoing, has centralized sequencing in four facilities in the United States, each which evaluates a tumor for 200 genes. The primary endpoint of NCI Match is clinical response rate, with a positive response defined as greater than or equal to 25%. A secondary endpoint of NCI Match is progression-free survival at 6 months with a rate of greater than or equal to 35%. So with the introduction of these new trial designs, we will see a potential for cancer defined by genetic mutation or genetic alteration rather than the histologic subtype or the organ of origin of the cancer.
And how is the situation in terms of the reference materials for sequencing?
So a major change that will occur over the coming decade will be the initiation of quality measures specific for cancer genomic laboratories. This will enable us to standardize sequencing methods and sequencing quality. Traditionally, clinical laboratories performing DNA testing would use reference materials which addressed or examined specific DNA variants at a single base of DNA. However, because the human genome is 3 billion bases, early on it was recognized that we needed to have novel reference materials which examined many more variants, if not the entire genome. In 2011, the United States National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, initiated a public private academic consortium known as Genome in a Bottle. This resulted in the first genomic reference material, NA12878, which was an established human cell line. The reference material is not only the DNA itself from the cell line, but it is also the data from the integration and arbitration of 14 genome sequencing data sets from multiple laboratories using five different sequencing technologies. In May 2015, the first version of Genome in a Bottle was released as a pilot reference material by NIST. The NIST Genome in a Bottle reference material will be critical for the advancement of clinical laboratory genomic assay validation and quality assurance.
And would you like to share any final comment on this topic?
The initial studies on cancer genomics in the clinical laboratory have demonstrated a potential utility. Over the next couple of years, we are likely to see cancer genomic testing become routine.
Professor Jason Park, yes, it has been a pleasure to have you in Microscopio. Thank you very much for sharing this interview with us.
Thank you very much.
Register in our website, www.infobiochimica.com, and receive El Microscopio's newsletter with information of new programs and the most relevant news of the week.
God in a war, no one's laughing at God when they're starving or freezing or so very poor. No one laughs at God when a doctor calls after some routine tests. No one's laughing at God when it's gotten real late and their kid's not back from that party yet. No one laughs at God when their airplane starts to uncontrollably shake. No one's laughing at God when they see the one they love hand in hand with someone else and they hope that they're mistaken. No one laughs at God when the cops knock on their door and they say, "We got some bad news, sir." No one's laughing at God when there's a famine, fire, or flood. But God could be funny at a cocktail party while listening to a good God thing joke. Or when the crazy say he hates us and they get so red in the head, you think they're about to choke. God could be funny when told he'll give you money. scented like a genie with his magic like Houdini, or grand wishes like Jiminy Cricket and Santa Claus. God can be so hilarious, ha ha. No one laughs at God in a hospital. No one laughs at God in a war. No one's laughing at God when they've lost all they got and they don't know what for. No one laughs at God on a day they realize that the last sight they'll ever see is a pair of hateful eyes. No one's laughing at God when they're saying their goodbyes. But God could be funny at a cocktail party while listening to a good goddamn joke. When the crazy say he hates us and they get so red in the head, you think they're about to choke. God could be funny when told to give you money if you don't pray the right way. And when presented like a genie with his magic like Houdini, or grants wishes like Jiminy Cricket and Santa Claus. God could be so hilarious. But no one laughs at God in a hospital. No one laughs at God in a war. No one laughs at God. Starving or freezing or so very poor. No one's laughing at God. No one's laughing at God. No one's laughing at God. We're all laughing with God.
This is El Microscopio on infobiochimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world. Our correspondents in every country. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor, from Mexico. José Jara, from Peru. Milagros de la Rosa, from Dominican Republic. Miriam Aguilera, from Honduras. Rafael Calafel, from Spain. Mario Chávez Villalobos, from Costa Rica. Dante Yáñez, from Bolivia. Leverton Ortiz, from Chile.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
El Microscopio is presenting the IFCC World Lab Congress 2017.
El Microscopio.
El Microscopio.
An online radio program about biochemistry.
News. IFCC President Position. The term of IFCC President-elect commences on January 1st, 2017, to be confirmed as IFCC President for the period January 1st, 2018 until 31st December 2020. Three candidates have been nominated by their national societies and all applications were declared valid. IFCC officers' elections take place electronically and IFCC full members constitute the voting members. For more information, you can visit www.ifcc.org. News. IFCC Awards. IFCC is proud to announce its distinguished award for presentation at the IFCC Congress in October 2017, Durban, South Africa. The IFCC Distinguished Awards will be conferred to scientists and clinicians who work in clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine or related disciplines to publicize their exceptional research and other contributions that have improved medical and healthcare, and to stimulate and encourage other scientists to accelerate their efforts in advancing clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine. News. IFCC E-News Flash. In the September IFCC E-News Flash, you will find updates on the Euromed Lab Congress in Athens from the 11th to the 15th June 2017, the presentation of the EJIFCC on cardiac biomarkers, and a highlight on the E-Academy webinar on children's reference intervals, the first of a series of four. Subscribe to ensure you receive all the latest news on www.ifcc.org.
O microscópio.
where can you find further information? We upload news about publications, websites, and institutions. El Microscopio. Agenda. Offering courses, workshops, seminars, congresses.
Agenda. The benefits and challenges of point-of-care testing across the clinical spectrum. 26th International CPOCT Symposium in Copenhagen, Denmark. From September 21st to September 24th, 2016.
Agenda.
The SPC, ML and IFCC Joint Symposium in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, on September 29th, 2016.
Agenda.
The First Scientific and Professional Congress of Cordoba, Argentina. Congress of Biochemistry, 2016. October the 4th to October the 8th, 2016.
Agenda.
The 2016 Conference of the Association of Clinical Chemists of Nigeria. In Nigeria, in October the 12th to October the 14th, 2016.
Agenda.
The 48th National Congress of Laboratory Medicine, the patient's central role between laboratory and clinical practice in Torino, Italy, from October the 18th to October the 20th, 2016.
Agenda.
The 10th National Congress of Clinical Laboratory in Zaragoza, Spain, from October the 19th to October 21st, 2016.
Agenda.
The joint meeting of the 3rd Congress of Controversies in Thrombosis and Hemostasis and the 8th Russian Conference of Clinical Hemostasiology and Hemorrhagy in Moscow, Russia, from October the 20th to October 22nd, 2016.
We are in El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com
on Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Argentina time
and at 11:30 a.m.
Venezuela time.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Professor Carl Backus is assistant researcher in the field of epigenetics and diabetes at Lund University in Sweden. He has found a new type of biomarker that can predict the risk of type 2 diabetes by detecting epigenetic changes in specific genes through a simple blood test. Dr. Carl Backus, welcome to Microscopio.
Thank you.
In this interview, we wanted to talk about new method measures the risk of type 2 diabetes in blood. And our first question is, what is epigenetics?
Well, there are several definitions of epigenetics. One that I like is the epigenetics is the study of mitotically or meiotically heritable changes in gene function that cannot be explained by changes in the DNA sequence. It's like, for example, DNA methylation or histone modifications or microRNA, for example. So things that change gene activity without changing the DNA sequence.
And what is DNA methylation and is it inheritable?
DNA methylation is the addition of methyl groups to DNA, and in differentiated mammalian cells, the vast majority of DNA methylation occurs on cytosines that are followed by guanines. So it's a so-called CpG site. And DNA methylation does different things depending on where in the DNA they occur. So if, for example, promoter methylation usually reduces gene expression due to inhibition of transcription factor binding or recruitment of other factors that reduce expression. And yes, it is inheritable. When a cell replicates and the DNA is replicated, the newly synthesized strand of DNA will be unmethylated. But an enzyme called DNA methylase transferase 1 will detect this. It's called hemimethylated DNA. And the enzyme will detect this and make sure that the methylation pattern from the parental strand is copied onto the new DNA strand. And so both daughter cells will have the same DNA methylation pattern. And then there's also evidence for transgenerational inheritance, which means that inheritance or epigenetic changes from one generation of an organism to another. And in the case of DNA methylation, the DNA methylation pattern is almost completely removed during early development. So any inherited DNA methylation changes are likely not directly inherited, but rather inherited through other mechanisms that perpetuate the DNA methylation pattern. But yes, it is inheritable.
Mm-hmm. And in your research, what predicts DNA methylation?
So we investigate the pancreatic islets of Langerhans from human donors, and we have shown that DNA methylation in these islets is affected by factors such as sex and age. And on top of this, there's also other factors. For example, nutrient stimulation changes the methylation pattern. So it's a multifactorial issue, not only in human islets, but in any tissue. And due to this complexity, it's impossible to perfectly predict at what levels a person's DNA will be methylated at a specific site. If you do have any information of most of these important parameters for any given tissue, you can make rough estimates of the DNA methylation level, but it will never be perfect.
And does the method include sequencing? And if it does, could you please tell us about that?
So there are several methods for analyzing DNA methylation. We normally start by doing analysis at the whole genome level. We have done microarrays, for example. And then we validate findings from these experiments with a method called prior sequencing. And this method allows us to analyze specific short stretches of DNA. So yes, prior sequencing is a kind of sequencing method. I will not go into all the details because it's going to be hard to follow it without having like pictures to look at. But we start by treating the DNA we want to analyze with bisulfate, which converts unmethylated cytosines to uracil, while the methylated cytosines remain unaltered. Then we amplify this DNA in a PCR reaction, and one of the primers is biotinylated. So we can, after the PCR is run, we can denature the product and isolate just one of the strands. And this strand we can then sequence in the pyrosequencing reaction. And by comparing the results with the known sequence, we can tell if the C cytosines we analyzed were methylated or unmethylated in the original DNA. Like I said, this was just a very brief explanation. There are very good videos and animations online explaining prior sequencing. So if anyone is interested, I would recommend to do an online search for prior sequencing, and you will find good videos explaining this method.
And when can the risk of developing diabetes type 2 be detected or identified?
So to a certain extent, we can already do this with available parameters such as BMI and different measures of blood glucose levels. But the precision of the prediction is low. In the latest study we published, we show that DNA methylation in blood then can be used as a predictor. But the predictive strength is not stronger than the factors we already have. The thing is, we only investigated a very, very small fraction of the CPG sites in the human genome, so around 20 out of almost 30 million. So there may be much, much stronger predictors out there. And we are now planning on using our genome-wide methods and prospective cohorts to see if we can find other CPG sites that have a stronger predictive potential than the ones we analyzed in this study. But to give you a time point when we can, with good precision, detect type 2 diabetes, that's difficult, but it's within a few years, hopefully.
Would you like to make any final comment on this new method?
Well, like I said, it's a proof of principle, but we have hope that it can be developed into a good method to predict diabetes.
Thank you very much, Professor Carl Backus. It's been a pleasure to have you in Microscopio.
Thank you very much.
Okay, goodbye.
This is El Microscopio on infobiochimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world, our correspondents in every country. Stella Raimondo from Uruguay, Fernando Ruiz Cerda from Chile, Montserrat González from Paraguay, Isabel Fierro from Ecuador, José Francisco Valle from Mexico, Oswaldo Ruiz Narváez from Costa Rica, Patrocinio Chuecas from Spain, Rodolfo Aquino Cáceres from El Salvador.
the team of El Microscopio, Hernan Ferres Taye, Silvana Bujan, Nicolas Bem, Sebastian Zener, Belen Landi, and Marcelo Elias.